On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you missed the show last week, we devoted part of it to exploring portrayals of food in television and film in New Orleans and in the Central Valley. This week, we continue our Food on the Screen series in Hong Kong at a restaurant called Megan's Kitchen. Roll the tape.
I got a man up.
The whole thing.
Yeah, see? YOLO.
Oh, it's not that bad. It just has like a weird aftertaste.
Cute.
It kind of gross.
How is it gross?
I like it.
It tastes like nothing. It just tastes like.
It tastes like
bait.
It's rotten.
It is rotten.
That clip comes from the Hong Kong episode of I'll Have What Phil's Having. The PBS show was created by television writer and producer Phil Rosenthal. A decade after his hit series Everybody Loves Raymond wrapped, Phil created the show to slowly eat his way around the world, from gelato in Italy to tacos in L.A. And I have to say, the best thing about the show for me, besides the fact that we all get to come along for the ride, is that Phil is himself. A lovely, open, funny, unpretentious fan. Hi.
Hi, that was nice.
Well, it's true. I think that so much food television we see these days, the act of eating and appreciating has become so elevated that it's fraught. And people are afraid to just bring who they are to the act of exploring.
When you say elevated, do you mean it's too highfalutin in a way?
Not necessarily highfalutin. There's so much attention put on it now.
You went on the slow-mo food close-up.
Yeah, all of
the
that.
The cheese pull.
Yeah, the Instagramming, the
yes.
Millions of food shows.
I'm guilty of being in that group, aren't I? I think I'm in there.
You are in there, but you bring something different to it. I think you bring permission for people to be afraid.
Oh, yes, because I am.
Yeah, but you let that show.
Yeah.
You don't have all this false bravado.
But if you're talking about somebody like, let's say, Anthony Bourdain, who I see as a superhero, I don't see a false bravado. This is a brave person. This is someone who's an adventurer.
That's true.
And I thought, if I'm going to get into this world, what's my show going to be like? Well, I can only be me. When I look at Anthony Bourdain, I say, this guy is fantastic. I'm never doing that. I'm the guy on the couch who watches Anthony Bourdain and say, look at him go. He's crazy.
But I think of so many people who don't even want to travel.
Yeah.
You've talked about Ray Romano himself.
Yes.
Where you had a conversation with him and you said, do you want to come to Italy?
Yeah.
And he didn't even want to travel. He had no interest.
No, none at all. And that's where this whole show came from. That first season of Everybody Loves Raymond, I asked him what he was going to do on his hiatus. And he said, I'm going to the Jersey Shore. And I said, why don't you go to Europe? And he said, man, I'm not really interested in other cultures.
Even though he himself is
Italian. Even his own culture. A light bulb went off. I said, we got to do an episode where we send him over as Ray Romano with that attitude. And we send him back as me after he's been transformed by the magic of traveling, of Italy, specifically of the food in Italy. That alone could get you to want to devote your life to traveling.
That was my transformative moment. Was it yours?
I think it was.
When you were a young man, adventuring.
I didn't get to go overseas till I was in my early 20s, but the top of my head came off. I couldn't believe that, first of all, food could taste this good. Simple food, a plate of pasta and sauce. The scenery was spectacular, that the way of life seemed more humane, that everything closes down. What do you mean? From 2 to 4? Nothing is open? Well, how do they get business done? They don't care so much about business. They care more about life. They want to enjoy the day. This is a novel concept to us, right?
And food is such a great, juicy way of having connection, which
That's it.
Causes everything else in life to work.
It's the great connector.
Yep.
We eat together. We always have, since we're cave people, right? If you and I kill a boar, we eat it together.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I'd like to see that too. We need Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, I think we would.
So then we would eat together. Why? Because we're sharing the thing to keep us alive, if for no other reason. So then for me, the next great connector, maybe even the deeper connector, is the sense of humor. So if my show is a little bit different from the other shows, maybe it's that.
I mean, the moment in your show, which happens every episode, where you speak to your parents on Skype.
I know. I know, like, they're the stars.
It's hilarious. They're always in their pajamas.
One time my dad came in his boxer shorts.
Did you tell him to put on a shirt?
You understand that we're filming this, right? What? I'm on the computer. They can't see. Yes, but the computer sees you when you came in the room to sit down at the computer. We saw. We see you. So what am I? I'm 80, whatever. So what?
So your brother also, your brother's on the crew.
He's a producer.
Did you go about this from the very beginning as a way to do something else with family?
Yes. I've been trying to get this show since I told you about that Raymond episode. When we shot that Italy episode, that was the year 2000. And what I saw happen to Ray, the character that I wrote, this arc of going from a xenophobe to being getting it, I said, what if I could do this for other people? Since the year 2000, and the show went off in 2005, I've been trying to do this. I've been doing other things, but I've been trying to get this show because this is, you know how Curb Your Enthusiasm is kind of the deeper expression of the guy behind Seinfeld?
Right.
This is it for me. So for better or worse, you have to look at me now. But all I've ever tried to do is connect with the people. When I was writing Raymond, I was connecting with you. You heard me. You just didn't know it was me. Now, sorry, you got to look at me too.
Talking about writing.
Yeah.
In this town, writers' relationship with food is famous. And the writers' rooms flow along on a trough, a sea of
food. The army travels on its stomach. So we made sure we had the best craft service in town. We were kind of legendary.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was very important. I would say after the quality of the work and just being a nice human being in general to the people that work with you, for you, food is a great way of showing people that you care about them and of making a family. And so if you go to the craft service table and it's just potato chips, popcorn, junk, candy, it's a quick fix. Nobody feels really good after, naturally. But let's say once in a while these cinnamon buns came in. Where are they from? They're from a place called Ann Sather's in Chicago. Or here's Delhi. It says Second Avenue Delhi. What do you mean? New York. Second Avenue Deli. Yes, people go out of their minds. Once a year, crab claws from Joe's Stone Crabs in Florida. This makes a family. Let's say you and I don't know each other. We could meet at the craft service. I say, have you tried this? Yes, it's right away we're talking. And it's about something nice.
It's about something delicious. So this obsession with food of yours,
yeah.
This love of it, and love of the relationships that come about through food and exploring, when did you realize that you could become a patron to chefs by becoming an investor?
Let's see. You know, obviously you have to have a little money. So it wasn't until I was somewhat successful in television. So I'd say around the early 90s when I was working in TV.
Who was your first person?
It was Suzanne Tracht.
With Jar.
Jar was the first thing I invested in. And then because she was a mom at our school. And my wife came home and said, Suzanne knows you're interested in food. Would you be interested in maybe investing in a restaurant? I said, yeah, just like that, just because I love it. So I invested, and I was really proud of it. And then a year later, the building was going to be sold, and Jar was going to be sold, and the restaurant's fantastic. I didn't want it to. So I said to my business manager, well, isn't there something we can do? And he said, you could buy it. So I bought the restaurant. It was the only restaurant I've ever owned outright. It was great for a while, and then the technical part of it became too much for me. I didn't want to be an owner. I realized I could have all the fun of ownership with none of the headaches by just investing. So I sold it to Suzanne, and it's still doing great. It's great because she's still there every day. And I took that money and I spread it around. It's like I'm supporting the arts.
It is exactly like you're supporting the arts. It's really important, and people in town don't understand that we need lovers of this particular art,
yeah,
in order to see it thrive.
It makes our town better.
Yeah.
It makes the world better. It makes L.A. the best food city in America.
So how many places have your hand in it now?
I've lost count.
I love that.
I'm not, and when people ask me, why do you invest in restaurants? I say, because I'm not very bright. You don't do it for money.
Yeah, because you don't always get all of it back.
How could you? It's stupid. It's like investing in a Broadway show or a boat.
Or a boat. Yeah. I love that.
Here's my criteria. Do I want to eat there? Do I like the chef? Do I like the food that this chef makes? Is this stuff I want to eat? That's it. And then I have a brain, which is called a business manager, who protects me from myself.
I have to congratulate you because straight out of the gate, first season of your show, you won a James Beard Award.
Yes, I'm not sure that you should be addressing me as something other than sir, because you listeners can't see it, but the medal hangs around my chest at all times like an Olympian.
So I have to think that all your years in television helped you really hone what you did. Did you understand that it was going to hit so phenomenally?
No, but I can say that this is the accumulation of everything I've learned in not just my life of eating, but my life of creating television. I would be stupid not to draw from what I've learned in the making of a show, because ultimately, I'm taking your time. I'd like to tell you a little story. And if there's not an inherent story in what I'm telling you, I'd like there at least to be a thread, a reason. Why am I watching this? The same criteria apply to any form of any storytelling, right? What is this about? What is the point? Well, I have a point. My point is to get you to travel. And if food and humor are the way in on this particular show, so be it. That's great.
And working with PBS, whose budgets are, I would imagine, less than...
A little bit.
Did the challenge of doing that end up being a good thing?
It didn't hurt. You know, I worked with a great production company called 0.0. They do all the Bourdain shows. They've been doing this for 16, 17 years. They do Mind of a Chef. They know what they're doing. They knew how to spend the money. We didn't suffer. I would say that it was harder for the crew because maybe there was a one day off between cities, like for three cities in a row, and the travel day, you don't think about it. The travel day is actually the hardest for the crew because they don't have a crew to carry their stuff for them. They are the crew. Actually, the travel day is actually harder. So it's like adding another horrible day to their week. So now, if we're lucky enough to go forward, and
I've heard you are.
We're in negotiations right now. I can't really say that it's done because I know once I do, I'll jinx it and you'll never see me again. But life will get nicer for them. So I'm happy about that. I would do, don't tell people, but I'd do this for free. I would. I mean, it's a dream.
Let's listen to a clip from the Italy episode of I'll Have What Phil's Having. You're visiting a gelateria in Florence that you frequented for the last 30 years.
Hey.
It's called Vivoli. Let's take a listen.
Oh, look at this. But I do need to taste everything.
Start with the chocolate.
This is my favorite, chocolate chip.
First of all, it's the best chocolate flavor I've ever had in anything.
Oh, thank you.
And then the generosity of the chips. It just, nobody does that.
Okay.
Okay. There's things I haven't. Come in. I would never get in front of a child.
I want that. Yeah, that one.
See, we're friends already.
It may be peach.
Yes.
Peach.
White peach.
Oh my God. I don't want to curse in front of the children. But...
We have to try also this one.
This is riso.
I try everything.
Like cold, delicious rice pudding.
If you like chocolate, you have to try the chocolate chip. They're the only ones that do it. It's the best I've ever had.
He's my PR.
It's the best in the world. I'm not a religious person, but Silvana is one of God's gifts to us. What I want chocolate chip and banana. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I had the best time with you.
Grazie.
Oh, it's sweet to me to hear it because even though we can't see it, it's evocative, right?
Yeah,
you get
absolutely.
The sense of it. Have you been there to
Vivoli? Oh, yes, many times.
So am I crazy or have you had better?
I've had equal.
Yeah, things are good in a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. I've had, like, in Rome, I've had some...
Giolitti.
Giolitti is wonderful, but Gracchi is wonderful, too. I had this celery ice cream.
Wow.
I went out on the street, I ate it.
Yeah.
I looked at my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And I went back in. And I ordered it again.
You know how to live.
But there was one moment when you were with Silvana in the laboratorio.
Yes.
And she handed you a spoonful of the crema right out of the machine. And
yes.
You actually teared up.
Yes. It was a combination of things. First of all, that is a lucky, lucky moment in somebody's life to have this thing you love at the source, at the moment of creation. There's nothing like picking something off the tree. There's nothing like the moment something is done from the hands of the master and popping it in your mouth. There is no time for it to change in a way that wasn't in the creator's head. It's a kiss from somebody special. That's how it felt. And it's an explosion of flavor. I don't have to tell you that you're tasting something absolutely phenomenal. And then it just made me want to give her a kiss on both cheeks. And I had just met this person literally in real time of the time it took to show you that segment. We started in the laboratory.
So you had been going there all these years without meeting her?
No.
Oh, I thought you had had a long relationship.
Met her that day.
Wow.
She stays in the back making the gelato. So now I felt like I say it in the thing. It's like, oh, I get to meet Michelangelo. We talk for a little bit. She explains that this is just eggs, milk, and sugar. That's it. But as we explain, it's the right milk, the right eggs, the right sugar in the right machine that's 60, 70 years old, and the right lady who knows how to do it. So I kiss her on both cheeks. It was just genuine. But then she kissed me right back without hesitation. And I think the combination of all those things made me emotional.
Verklempt.
A little bit, because that's Italy to me. The expression of love comes in so many ways. It comes in their craft of what they do and the food and the ingredients. They wouldn't consider lesser ingredients because there's no love in a lesser ingredient. This has to be perfect. It's for people. That comes through in everything they do, in the chair you're going to sit in the little piazza you're going to sit in the chair in, and then in the way they hug and kiss you. Why wouldn't you want to live in Italy?
Don't ask me that question, or I'll start to cry.
So I was trying to express that first in the Raymond episode that I wrote, and then in my own personal story. I think it's the best one. It's the best one for me because it would be fake if we had a personal story in every episode. You can't. But this one had it, and it was real. And that's what we look for.
Such a great show.
Thanks.
I will light a candle so we get to see the next one.
I'm planning it. I fingers crossed.
Thank you so much, Phil.
I love being here. Let's go eat.
Let's go eat.
Okay.
We've been talking with Phil Rosenthal about I'll Have What Phil's Having. Watch video of Phil eating that great gelato from Vivoli on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. For a different kind of voice encouraging us to explore the world through food, we turn to Eddie Wong. His show Wong's World airs on Viceland TV. Here's a clip from the Shanghai episode in which Eddie and his fixer are at a restaurant called Old Jesse.
What is your favorite thing to eat here?
Well, we did order the codfish head, which is my absolute favorite, I think, dish in Shanghai. But their crab roe anything is really good. Crab roe tofu, crab roe shrimp, which is what we have.
Yeah. Of the red cooked porks I've had, theirs is either the first or second best red cooked pork I've had in Shanghai. They do a really good job with this. But you see how dark and lacquered this is.
Yeah.
Hong Shou roe here, they boil it in water and wine. The way I do it is we'll start it in a pan, fry it dry, set it aside, come back with the chilies and all kinds of aromatics. So that's Mao style Hunan Hong Shou roe. And the legend was that Mao had a virgin and a plate of Hong Shou roe every night.
Hi, Eddie.
How's it going?
In that clip from the Shanghai episode, you comment on the difference between the red cooked pork prepared at Old Jesse and the red cooked pork you grew up with in Orlando. Did the difference between the two surprise you?
You know, every time I go to China, it does surprise me. There's always new dishes. There's always new things they're doing. In America, you always see ethnic food like in a time capsule. And it's like, this is ethnic food. This is the way it is. It's traditional. And these are the dishes we're going to serve for the next 500 years. Food in China is changing every single day. Food in Jamaica is changing every single day. So it is in the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico. And we have to understand that whatever we're eating here is just one moment, one iteration. And they're constantly cycling through dishes there as well.
One of the big moments in the Chengdu episode was this moment that you have rabbit stomach and a special Mapo tofu. So here's that tape.
Right on cue, this is their most famous dish. This is what they're known for. You can't get this anywhere else. This is Mapo tofu with pig brains. You will never have a version as good as this. It's creamy, it's silky, it has the essence of the pig brain, but it's clean, and it's almost like eating uni in your Mapo tofu. And I'm sure some idiot is gonna do mapo tofu with sea urchin, and it's gonna be f***ed up because the flavors don't match. But pig brains give you that creaminess, and it has that synergy with the mapo tofu because it's always had ground pork alongside of it.
Pig brain in mapo tofu. Awesome.
It's funny because even as food is quickly evolving in China, other facets of society are moving more slowly.
Yeah.
You talk about this in your new memoir, Double Cup Love, which was just published last month.
You know, there's a lot of things that China can see but can't touch. They can get on a website and see what's there, but when they go to download it, it takes too long. It'll never finish downloading and they can't get it. And the firewall is a very real thing there, which renders Chinese people in this state where they're like goldfish looking at the rest of the world through this bowl. It's sad. People used to say to me, even liberal people in China, they'd say, you know what? China has to do this to protect China because we're not ready for the complete freedom that America has. We don't have as much equality in income. We don't have as much equality in education. And when they said that, I almost laughed because I'm like, you think we have equality in income? Like, it's entirely unequal here. And then I was like, education, like, good God, like, it's totally different from neighborhood to neighborhood in New York. But it's even worse in China. I do understand certain aspects of it, which may be hard for Americans to stomach. China is trying to build an infrastructure, it's trying to build a company, and it had to pull a billion people out of poverty. At first, it seemed wicked, it seemed authoritarian, and it was. But now that you're starting to see the product of it, look at all these countries that took IMF loans and are forever like on the teat of the superpowers. China, you know, it stinks that you can't touch, you can only see, but they have their own YouTube, they have their own Twitter, they have their own telecom industries, and it's allowed China to grow, and their people are coming around. And I do think very soon the firewall will have to be lifted, and they'll have to deal with people that are ready for freedom. But you were dealing with a group of people that were in extreme poverty with no opportunity at the bottom of Maslow's pyramid, and you can't just give people everything at one time.
At what point in the book you ask, quote, did my constant fear of assimilation and foreign interference come from being a child of the rootless diaspora, unquote? After you went through being in China, cooking in China, do you feel more settled in yourself and who you are?
Yes. And, you know, the first book, Fresh Off the Boat, was very much the voice of a 29-year-old kid who had been silenced his whole life, who felt there was a thumb on him the entire time, and I was just trying to break out. I was trying to create my own place in America. I was trying to create my voice, and I fought for it. And you can see it and you can hear it in that book. This book is me dealing with acceptance and dealing with kind of society, accepting who I am, liking my work, and wanting to assimilate me and wanting to kind of claim me. And I fought with it and I struggled with it, and it was very strange to have a platform and I have this show on ABC about my life. And this book really goes through a lot of what I've been thinking the last few years and learning to love myself. Before I could let anybody else love me, I had to learn to love myself.
Well, thank you so much, Eddie, as always.
Always. Thanks for the time.
We've been talking with Eddie Wong, host of Wong's World on Viceland TV. His new book is Double Cup Love, On the Trail of Family, Food, and Broken Hearts in China. Tune into the show next week for more stories in our Food on the Screen series. Next, because I know we made you very hungry, we learn how to make Chinese food at home. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Nostalgia and yearning for taste of home can push us to do things we never would have imagined. Ask Qian Lam Ko. After immigrating from Asia in the 70s, he decided it was better to write his family for instructions on how to prepare familiar dishes than to stomach the Cantonese fare at his neighborhood Chinese restaurant. His book, Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, is a beautiful introduction to Chinese home cooking. Hi, Kian.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
I heard you describe yourself as a nerd and a software engineer writing for other nerds who love food.
Yes. When I started cooking and was looking at different recipes, very often when something goes wrong, I don't know how to fix it. My scientific background sort of tells me I really should find out why the mistake happens. And that is when I started looking into the actual background techniques and the actual process to cook a dish and so on. You know, whenever I teach, I tell people that recipes are there just as a guideline.
Did you grow up cooking?
I have always been interested in cooking. I really didn't start cooking until I went to college. At home, you know, we live in this huge family. You know, I didn't really have a chance to actually go into the kitchen and cook. Going to college in Boston, because that was where I first went when I came to America, I decided that I need to learn how to make Chinese food because I couldn't find any good Chinese cooking there. And that's when I started cooking.
Where are you from in China?
My family is from Fujian province, just a little bit north of the Guangdong region. I was born in Indonesia, but I grew up in Singapore.
What an incredible experience. Your blog is titled redcook.net. Could you describe red cooking and its place?
Red cooking is one of the most basic braising techniques in Chinese cooking. It basically means that you're slow cooking a tough cut of meat that is braised in liquid, soy sauce, wine, and sugar. You add aromatics and sometimes you add spices to it. But the basic component is the soy sauce, wine, and sugar. Just about every regional cooking has their own, you know, red cook dish. And the most popular one, which is red cook pork belly. For example, if you go to Sichuan, they would probably put a little bit extra chili just to give it a kick. But if you go further to the north, it will not be as spicy. They wouldn't even put any spice in it. It will be just liquid with aromatics in it.
Let's talk about stir frying, because I think it's the technique many of us associate with Chinese cuisine. But reading through your cookbook, there's not just one way to stir fry.
There is a very basic process that almost all stir-frying technique follows. The first step is to par-cook the protein, if you have a protein. You remove the protein after it's only been cooked about three-quarter done. Usually what I mean is that the inside of the ingredient is still slightly raw, but on the outside it's already cooked. And then back into the wok, we put in some oil, aromatics. We sweat the aromatics until it's a little bit fragrant. Put in accompanying vegetables. The accompanying vegetables will then get cooked. And finally, we put the protein back into the wok. Before serving, we then season it. You can either season with sauces, different kind of sauces, or different kind of condiments, or just simply salt and pepper. There are three very common variations of that. The first one is what I call a dry stir fry, and the second one I call a moist stir fry. The final one is a simple stir fry. Now, a dry stir fry, you know, when you add flavoring ingredients at the end, it's basically just enough flavoring to just coat the ingredients. So you end up with this stir fry that doesn't have any gravy, doesn't have any sauce. And the second type of stir fry, which is a moist stir fry, you add extra liquid to it. You end up with a dish that has gravy. A kung pao chicken is a dry stir fry because you just have chicken with sauces coated on the outside and peanuts and chili, no gravy. Moku kai pan, on the other hand, which is a moist stir fry, it's chicken and mushroom and other vegetables, but at the end, you always end up with this gravy. So that's the difference between those two techniques. And then there is one final technique that is the most commonly used one. It's what we call simple stir fry. A simple stir fry basically is just one ingredient, meaning that you just either stir fry one single vegetables or one single meat. And in that situation, what you do is you skip the first step of par cooking the protein. You just start with the oil and the aromatics, and then you put in whatever the single ingredient is, either vegetable or beef or pork or chicken. Cook them through until it's fully cooked, and then you sauce it. It's very good for leafy vegetables, like spinach, for example, or pea shoots, or napa cabbage. Those are the three most commonly used variations of stir fry.
That kind of stir fry kind of leads us into deep frying, which is just a really intriguing chapter of the book, because there are so many ways of using oil almost like it's liquid in the Chinese kitchen.
I would say that one of the most interesting deep frying technique, which is called the yin yang deep frying, what you do is you drop the dumpling into very hot oil. So immediately what it does is it would seal the outside of the food. And then you pour in a little bit of room temperature oil to reduce the temperature of the oil. As the oil reduces, it slowly cooks the inside of the ingredients. So the result is that you have this crispy skin on the outside, but still moist inside. So that's one of the techniques that I just love. I just thought it's an amazing revelation to me.
I think one reason that people sort of don't want to get into deep frying at home is the oil. They have no idea what to do with the leftover oil. Do you use a separate machine or do you just use your wok?
I just use my wok. I think of wok as being a multi-purpose kitchen utensil. It's amazing what you can do with a wok. You know, I do save the oil and use it for deep fry for two or three times, but I would use it within like 2 or 3 weeks because then it becomes stale. Yeah.
You have this technique where it's poaching in oil.
Right. It's a very interesting technique. And this technique is mostly used for like tender meat, fish, a whole fish, or a chicken breast. So what you do is you heat the oil very high temperature, drop the whole fish into the oil so it immediately seals the outside of the fish. And then what you do is turn the heat off. Once you turn the heat off, the fish will continue to cook. By this time, the temperature oil is already slowly dropping, and so it's slowly cooking the inside of the fish. You know, the result is that it's tender and it's juicy. So that's one of the techniques that I really love.
I can't thank you enough for hanging out with me for a little while. It's really been wonderful. I really can't wait to get into the kitchen with your book.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Qian Lam Ko. His new book is Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. Find a recipe for 3-cup chicken on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we find out what's changing hands at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Stay close.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's time for the Market Report. Let's see what Laura Avery is shopping for this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's so good that we have eyes and ears at the farmer's market. No one person can possibly see and taste everything here at the market. And I'm so happy today to be talking with Sarah Delavan, who is the food sourcing manager for Heirloom LA, and they're well known for their wonderful catering truck and their famous lasagna cupcakes. Tell us what you're sourcing today for Heirloom LA.
Today, I am on the lookout for really fabulous nectarines. I am looking for a selection of yellow nectarines that have a bit of acidity and some white nectarines that are going to be a little bit on the sweeter side. Tenorelli Orchards has a great diamond bright nectarine we picked up already this morning. That's the yellow variety. And Regeer Family Farms, we went ahead and got the diamond pearl nectarine. Really sweet, great texture on both of those. We're loving them right now.
Okay, and the difference between the white and the yellow, as with the peaches, it's all about sweetness versus acid, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. I'm really drawn to acidic, so the yellow is something that I favor, but I really respect and also have a great appreciation for the white fruit. So it's been a very tasteful morning here for us. I think we've had 10 to 12 different nectarines so far, and we're really pleased with the two that we chose.
You know, people used to rely on a certain month of the year or the farmer's almanac or when something was going to be ready. And have you found over the last couple of years, all bets are off?
I have. And as a Virgo, a true Virgo, it drives me crazy. I have a database of the past 3 years of what's in season when and where did I get it from. And I used to think that I could help to create our monthly menus using that database, and I can't. You really have to be at the market a couple times a week and really have conversations with farmers. What's coming up next? What have you got? And I, as a part of my job, get to go back and drop little cherries and little wild plums onto people's desks and have them sort of experience a little taste of the market, which I think might be my favorite part of the job.
Are you the one who kind of drives the menu? You'll say, this is what's in season, guys, and this is what we need to make?
Our executive chef, Matthew Poley, will come up with the general outline of the menu. And then he'll say things to me like, what's the best stone fruit right now? Or, you know, he'll kind of give me cues and then we'll collaborate. So I do, in a way, drive what's available on our menus, but it's very much a collaboration. And Matt is the creative force behind everything that we serve.
And what are you going to be making with the nectarines?
This week, we're making roasted Tenerelli nectarines. We're going to throw in some of the white nectarines from Regeer Farm as well, with some JF Organic Farms baby carrots. And with those vegetables, we're going to have dill, some fennel pollen that we sourced from the garden of a few weeks ago, and a little bit of white balsamic vinegar. I love this idea that Matt has to roast the fruit and to serve it with carrots. I think it's just delicious and unexpected.
Do the carrots and the nectarines roast together at the same time?
They don't. We roast them separately. They're going to require a little bit of a different cooking time, and you want both of them to be roasted to perfection. And then we'll gently toss them with the additional ingredients right before service.
Are the carrots cooked whole?
Yeah, so I'm looking for a small carrot when we do this side dish. I love McGrath Farm, Weiser Farm, JF Organic Farm, the multicolored kind of small carrots. So you can really do one or two bites and they can be roasted whole and beautiful.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. All right, well, Sarah, thank you so much. It's always great to see you here and look at your cart and get some tips. So appreciate you sharing your observations with us.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
That was Sarah Delavan, and she is the food sourcing manager for Heirloom LA, and she comes to the market every week. And if you want to just follow Sarah around and see what she's getting, you wouldn't go wrong buying exactly what she's buying. I'm talking now with John Tenerelli, who was growing those wonderful nectarines that Sarah was talking about. John is one of our few LA County farmers. There are farms in LA County. John, tell us where your farm is and why it is that your nectarines and all your fruit is so delicious.
We're in Little Rock, California, which is right near Palmdale, California, Antelope Valley. And we grow fruit at high elevation, so we're a little cooler than the San Joaquin Valley, which allows the fruit to stay on the tree a little bit longer and develop a little more flavors. And we have 80 varieties of fruit, but we're always bringing the freshest fruit. That is the main thing, is the freshness.
Are you the one who decides you're out there every day, and will you go to one tree and pick the ripest one day and then go back and pick more the next day and keep going until they're all gone?
Right. We pick one variety, and then 4 days later, we go in again.
How many kinds of nectarines do you grow?
8 or 9 yellow nectarines and 8 or 9 white nectarines. In Little Rock, we grow everything sustainably. You know, we use organic sprays for worms. We use only one herbicide spray instead of 4, and we use organic mulch from the San Fernando Valley, which we get free, and that's mixed in with the commercial fertilizer also. Mm-hmm. We're weed whacking weeds instead of killing them with poisons. You know, I've been growing for my family to eat, and I think our stuff is safer to eat than anybody's, even some of the organic growers, the certified organic growers, but mm-hmm. Anyways.
And how many acres do you have?
We have 13 small orchards, several 2.5-acre parcels. We have 2 10-acre parcels. Then I've got a lot of open land that we've pulled out stuff and haven't decided what to plant in those spots yet, so it's spotty all over the place. Right now, it's about 45 acres planted.
John, I love, you know, your sustainable program. You have a lot of natural predators, and you told me once that you planted mulberries, these wonderful Persian mulberries, to keep the birds out of your cherries. And then when you found out how delicious the mulberries were, you started bringing those too.
Yeah, my dad actually planted about 4 mulberry trees on the side of the cherry orchard right when he planted them. He says, in Italy, this is what we do. The birds eat the mulberries and they leave the cherries alone. Well, so what happened? They ate the mulberries and they ate the cherries too. So
there weren't that many mulberries.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't tried a Persian mulberry, there's nothing like them. All right, well, that's so interesting, and you are so beloved here at the market, so we're glad you're back, and can't wait to just taste your fruit all summer. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That was John Tenorelli, and he is the farmer owner of Tenorelli Orchards up in Little Rock, and it seems like he's getting better every year. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Get that recipe for roasted nectarines and baby carrots on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
The idea is, as far as I can tell, blinged out Korean barbecue.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold.
There's a dish there which I haven't gotten the LA Times expense accounts not being what they used to be. A bone-in tomahawk steak cooked on a gold-plated grill. Topped with foie gras for $150, something like that.
So are we going east, west?
We're going to Hanji in Culver City.
The fact that it's in Culver City is in itself news.
Right. I mean, everybody loves Korean barbecue. Occasionally people on the west side don't want to schlep for it. So this is a collaboration between the chef Chris Oh, who's the guy behind Seoul Sausage, which is a well-loved, funny fusion place on Sawtelle, and there's one in Little Tokyo. And Stéphane Bombay, who's behind the French restaurants Vivienne and Tureen.
Given that it's Korean barbecue, let's right. start at the beginning. How do the banchan, the little plates, hold up?
They're good. I mean, they're not great good. I mean, they're not the one that anybody's grandmother is going to go backwards about. But there's a really nice sort of, you know, aged cabbage kimchi. There's sort of candied dried squid strips that I like a lot. Sometimes there's just simple broccoli florets with like a little salt and sesame oil.
What did you order?
The thing that I liked the best there was possibly the least Korean, which was a ribeye steak. I mean, not the blinged out one. It just, but it was a nice marbled ribeye, little bit of age on it, tossed on the grill, flipped over a few times, cut so at the end, so bits of it caramelized. And it was very much a steakhouse experience rather than a Korean barbecue experience.
Did you still end up tucking it into something and blinging it out yourself before you put it in your mouth?
Sometimes I would dip it in the, you know, sort of soy-based dipping sauce with slivered scallions in there. Sometimes I would dip it in a little thing of salt. But, you know, a steak is a steak. You don't really have to do that much to it. The problem is that when you get to the actual Korean barbecue, I think, the meats tend to be bland. The tabletop grill isn't super high powered and it's gas instead of having even the slightest bit of charcoal to it. So the meat cooks a long time and sometimes it gets gray before it caramelizes and gets crisp. And if you're going for a straight Korean barbecue experience, that's probably not where you'd go.
Wow, that's too bad.
Yeah, it is. And I think it'll probably get better. The quality of the meat is excellent. Some of the marinades are good. But it just doesn't quite come together. But there are lots of dishes that aren't traditional Korean barbecue that are fun there. They do a pot of fluffy steamed eggs that you see in a lot of the better Koreatown places, except here, Oh tops it with uni and salmon roe.
Well, that sounds great.
It was delicious. They do fried pork rinds, chicharrones, with like a kimchi-flavored dipping sauce. There's something I really liked, which was corn cheese, the same kind of corn cheese, which is, say, corn and cheese, that you find in, you know, almost every Korean bar in L.A. But it had a giant marrow bone sticking out of it.
Okay, so you've got the corn and the cheese.
Right.
And then you add the marrow into it.
Right.
A little rich.
One pot of the corn cheese will probably suffice for like 6 or 8 people around a table.
Wow.
But, you know, there's nothing the matter with a big marrow bone.
Not at all.
And lately he started to add some of the dishes from Seoul Sausage to it. So you can get a bulgogi poutine.
That's really nice. It sounds actually like it's a perfect place for Culver City.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody would go there for a super serious meal, but as a place to go sort of after work or after movies, it's not bad. The only dessert they have, you'll be interested to know, is half a hollowed-out watermelon into which watermelon balls are put back into it along with fruity pebbles and pop rocks. And then over that, they pour soju.
So fruity pebbles and pop rocks seem to be a theme in Korean restaurants lately.
It's true. We just talked about the cotton candy with pop rocks and fruity pebbles recently.
That's so funny. Well, thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Hanjeep in Culver City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations from Jonathan. Now, just in time for summer, we close out this week's show around the fire. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Humans are the only animals that cook their food. It's what distinguishes us from them. There's something about an open flame that brings us together and builds community. Greg Denton and Gabrielle Quiñones Denton know this all too well. The husband and wife duo are chef owners of the Portland restaurant Ox. In their first cookbook, Around the Fire, they share their take on Argentinian-style grilling from the Pacific Northwest. Hi, you two.
Hello.
Hi.
Let's jump right into it. At Ox, you do live fire and asador cooking. Tell us what these are and how they're different from one another.
Well, we love the flavor of what charcoal and what wood do to food. We love the simplicity of serving something with salt, pepper, olive oil, and then what flavor, the light smoky, light charred flavor that happens when you cook over live fire. Specifically, the asador cooking on our parrilla, which is Spanish for the grill, is something that they kind of, and it's in our book, and there's a large picture of it. You can see these kind of V-channel bars that go across the grill. So normally where you would have just a normal bar, we have these V-channels. They're at a slight angle as well. So as you cook, these V-channels capture juices and fats, and there's a couple reasons why this is beneficial. One is that the juices and fats don't fall onto the fire, which therefore flares up and sometimes can add a flavor that's not desirable to your meat. But then also as these juices and fats fall to the forward area of the grill into these pans where their juices and fats are collected, they pick up smoke and flavor. And then in these pans, we have lemon, garlic, herbs, onion in there. So what we do is then we rebase most of our meats with this thing we call black gold because we think it's really valuable and it's kind of our signature. When you come to Ox, when you eat there, people are like, I can't believe the steak is so good. Well, it's because it's our flavor of steak because of all these great flavors that happen.
It's like your secret sauce.
It is. You could make it. I mean, we have a recipe in the book where you can kind of duplicate it even on if you don't have an asado, but the fact is we're a very busy restaurant that we have pork chops and chorizo and morcilla and sweetbreads and steaks and all these things have different marinades. And so all these different types of juices all collect together. So it's that flavor is definitely ours in a certain respect.
This secret sauce, this black gold that you're talking about is sort of like the grill equivalent of what a pasta cooker is for restaurants that rely a lot on these giant vats of boiling water to cook pasta, but then also cook all different kinds of vegetables.
Absolutely. And I don't know if it's the same, but we kind of consider it's that umami, that extra flavor that people just can't put their finger on. And we've been accused a few times, actually, of putting MSG on our food because people can't. They're just like, there's no way that you're getting this much flavor from your grill or from something like that. And we're like, you can look around our kitchen. Like, we don't use MSG. It's just concentrated
savoriness.
Savoriness, yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about the challenges or maybe the ease of some of these other meats that you grill, sweetbreads and morcilla, but also turkey and quail, right?
I think the main key with cooking some of these other items is patience more than anything. I think it's very traditional and relatively easy to, you know, get your grill blazing hot and throw on some steaks and get a good sear on them and pull them off. And they don't need much more other than a little bit of salt and pepper. Say something like a turkey butt or tail or a short rib that needs to spend considerable more time on the grill so that you can not only coax the flavor out of it, but also really render it to that point where you're getting the texture that you're looking for.
You kind of use the grill for certain cuts. You kind of need to think of it as kind of an oven in a certain respect. Sometimes closing the lid, having a piece of meat near the fire but not directly over the fire is a key to a lot of those offcuts. And as Gabby mentioned too, it's patience. Like we have a lamb shoulder chop, and that's in the book, and we also have it on the menu. I think one of the challenges is finding someone to cut you a lamb shoulder chop. You might have to go to a butcher to get it. To get past the thing that people think, okay, well, a lamb loin, it's going to be medium rare. It's actually okay to cook meat past a medium rare into medium well zone, because some cuts just need a little bit more time. They need, if you pull them off too soon, they're going to be rubbery. The fat's not going to be rendered enough. The connective tissue isn't going to dissolve. It needs some of that time. And the more time you give some of these cuts, the nicer and the juicier and the more flavorful they're going to be. And I think that's something that we really wanted to express to people when we wrote this book.
I cannot tell you how happy I am to hear you say that. Because particularly, I mean, I grew up with shoulder chops, lamb shoulder chops, and we always cooked them more towards the totally medium or medium well side.
And it's almost like you're shamed if you do that now.
It's true.
If you've ever been to Argentina or South America, they do have a tendency to cook their meat well. Some of the cuts, I'm a little like, wow, you really cooked that really well. Maybe that didn't need to go. Like the skirt steak, I think, is a good example of something that I prefer medium rare to medium. I think that's the perfect cook for that steak. But their short ribs and some of their other larger cuts, and definitely some of their offal cuts, like they do intestine and they do sweetbreads, and that needs time on the grill to like develop flavor. And the more time you give it, the crunchier, the more delicious it's gonna be.
So when you're cooking with so much wood, how much do you go through a night?
We go through probably about 200 to 300 pounds a night. We go through about a cord of wood a week.
Wow. So when you cook with that much wood, you have a lot of coals. Do you ever cook anything directly on the coals?
We do. You can cook directly over wood, which is one way. But what we do at Ox is that we actually have a fire cage in back. So we actually load our wood in the back, and it's just really hot back there. And that cooks the wood, then turns to coal, and then we pull the coals out underneath it. So what we do is when those coals are ripping hot, we'll throw halibut. We have a bone-in, skin-on halibut that we just, you know, salt, pepper, a little bit of oil, olive oil, and we set that directly on the coals in a basket so that we can actually move it around. But that goes directly on the coals. And what we like about that is that the skin gets really crispy, and it kind of just, it just surprises the piece of flesh that it just, it cooks really hot on the outside. After it rests for a minute, after you cook it, it just becomes a different piece of halibut than you've ever had. It just really makes it extremely tender, and then the juices just shoot out of it.
Juicy and unctuous and almost rich without heaviness.
Yeah.
We also love to take vegetables, something basically like at the end of the night when the coals are mostly spent, when we're not adding any more heat to the fire, we'll take items like beets.
Or onions.
And cover them completely in some of these coals and just let them slow cook overnight. And because they both have protective skins, it's very easy just to peel away that exterior and reveal a really nice, sweet vegetable after it's done.
Do you ever play with thinner skin summer vegetables or fruit even?
Oh, yeah. We do a cantaloupe dish when it's prime time here. We skin the cantaloupe and then we fill the center of the cantaloupe. We remove the seeds. We fill the center with cheese curds that
cut
have been cut in half with cheese curds that have been tossed with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. And then we basically put it in the back of the grill and we set it directly on the coals. Basically, the cheese starts to melt and we start to pull it like you would mozzarella, but we're pulling it inside the cantaloupe center. So you're getting all these great flavorful charred melon juices. Then we pull it out and we'll shave prosciutto on it, hit it with a little bit of olive oil and a tiny bit of parsley, and that's how we serve it. It's fantastic.
Wow. Gabrielle, I understand that your latest venture is a new place called Super Bite.
That's right.
What is a Super Bite?
For us, a Super Bite just means something that has really big flavor that you think you want more of, but if you were to eat too much more of it, it would probably be too rich. That one bite of it is just perfection. Another idea of a Super Bite for us is when you take two different components of dishes that aren't necessarily intended to be eaten together, but then when you do eat them together, you end up making a Super Bite from it. It ends up being so much better than each individual component was to begin with.
Give me an example.
We have a dish we call SpaghettiOs, and it's just hand-cut penne pasta, so it looks like SpaghettiOs, and we add truffles and Irish butter and chives to it, and it's really rich and delicious. But it's just a small dish, and people just are going absolutely crazy for it.
And it's just two bites worth, but it's the perfect amount.
Yep.
So do people order, like in a Chinese restaurant, tons of dishes all together? Or is it like a tasting situation where they come one at a time, one after another?
We kind of do it in a bit of a rapid fire tasting menu style way, kind of. So people order it, and sometimes they'll land one after another, and you might not be completely done with the next item yet. So we're not clearing between each, but we try to do it one at a time unless people request that we do it all together.
We really encourage our servers to read the table and get an idea about what kind of experience people are looking for. If they're looking for something more of a tapas experience where, you know, three or four dishes might hit the table at the same time, then we're going to do our best to accommodate that. But we also want to make sure that we're never rushing our guests through the meal and making sure that we kind of help with the progression of the dishes, maybe from lighter to heavier, or something where you might start off drinking a white wine with something and then progress into deeper, richer reds. We would kind of send the food out in a way that if there were more than one dish hitting the table at the same time, that they're going to complement each other and also ideally complement what you're drinking with it.
We've been talking with Greg Denton and Gabrielle Quiñones-Denton. Their new cookbook is Around the Fire, recipes for inspired grilling and seasonal feasting from Ox Restaurant. You can taste their food for yourself at Terrine later this month. It's a fire-centric feast that they're cooking with Chef Chris Morningstar. Get more details about the event on our website. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com via iTunes or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Lara Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and a special shout out to Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.